This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The book of Samuel 1 today, which means we've got to do three chapters, which we hopefully will manage to do. That will enable us to finish the book before next week, which is Purim. And we'll be having a Purim party here next Monday night, preceded by a short shiur, but it will be on the subject of Purim. So it would be nice if we're able to finish the story of Shmuel Aleph, the first book of Samuel, this evening. The shiur tonight is sponsored by Corey Schwartz and Rabbi Pogro in partnership. So thank you very much to them. We're going to be doing chapter 29, 30 and 31. We're up to the point where Shaul has been told by the spirit of Samuel, by the spirit of Shmuel, that he is going to die, that he's going to go into battle and he's going to die. And we analyzed that in a great deal of depth last week, and we spoke about the greatness of Shaul in choosing to go into that battle, even knowing as he did that he was going to die. I'm going to ask you please to make an effort to come at 8:15. That way not everybody arrives at the registration desk at the same time, and we can get started by 8:30. Now, an interlude in that, just before we come on to the issue of the battle with the Philistines, we deal with an aside in chapter 29. The Philistines mobilized their entire army. This is on page 718. The Philistines mobilized their entire army to Afek. Israel was encamped by the spring, which is in Israel. The governors of the Philistines were passing by with hundreds and thousands, and David and his men were passing at the rear with Achish, the king of the Philistines. Don't forget, Achish was protecting David from the pursuit of Shaul. The Philistine officers said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish replied to the Philistine officers, "Is this not David, the servant of Shaul, king of Israel, who has been with me for these days and all these years? And I have found no fault with him from the day he encamped with me until this very day. He's been very loyal. So I have no problem at all with him accompanying us on this battle." But the Philistine officers were angry with him. The Philistine officers said to him, "Send this man back and let him return to the place that you assigned to him. Let him not go down to battle with us, so that he not be an antagonist to us in the battle. He'll be a Trojan horse. How can we have Jewish soldiers in the middle of our army as we go into battle with the Jews? Is it not with the heads?" Send him back. With what can this person ingratiate himself to his lord? Is it not with the heads of these our men? Don't you realize he's got to carry favor with Shaul again? Shaul is the king. They don't know, of course, that David is destined to become the king. So if you just think, they say to Achish, don't you realize that the most politically expedient thing that David can possibly do is hand us over to Shaul, to his king, to the king? Is this not David of whom they sing with the timbrels, saying, Saul is slain in his thousands and David in his tens of thousands? This is not a naive person. This is a highly skilled politician and army general. And we can't have him in our midst. So Achish called David and said to him, as Hashem lives, you are an upright person. And your going forth and coming in with me in the camp would have been fine with me. For I have found nothing wrong with you from the day of your coming to me until this very day. But in the eyes of the governors, you are not good. So now return and go in peace and do not what is wrong in the eyes of the Philistine governors. I don't have a problem, my men have a problem, and they require that you go back, and so you better do that. David then said to Achish, but what have I done, and what fault have you found with your servant from the day I have been before you to this very day, that I should not come and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? So Achish answered and said to David, I know, for in my eyes you are as good as an angel of God. that the Philistine officers have said he shall not go up with us in battle. So now arise early in the morning along with the servants of your Lord who came with you. All of you arise early in the morning. When it becomes light enough for you, go. So David and his men arose early to leave in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, while the Philistines ascended to Israel. So for a period of time, David and his men have been out of their camp, walking, marching with the Philistine army, and they're now told to go back. Into chapter 30. Vayehi bevor David v'anoshov Tziklag b'yom ha'shlishi. It was when David and his men arrived in Tziklag on the third day that the Amalekite had spread out to the south and to Tziklag. They had attacked Tziklag and burnt it with fire. They had captured the women in it, from small to great. They did not kill a person, but led them off and went their way. All the men were out of the city of Tziklag. They were all in the army. So the town was a town of women and children. The Amalekites came, which was typical of the Amalekites, not to fight an army, not to fight an open battle with armed adversaries, but always to go after the old and the weak and the unprotected. So the Amalekites came in fact, and did just that. They attacked the women and the children. They didn't kill anybody, didn't even hurt anybody. They simply carted them off. When David and his men arrived at the city, and behold, it was... right onto page 720 and 721, it was burst in fire, and their wives and sons and daughters had been captured. David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no strength to weep. Imagine coming back and finding wives, children, families gone, disappeared, captured. Both of David's wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Israel and Abigail, the former wife of Nabal. David was very distressed, for the people were ready to stone him. For the soul of all the people was embittered, each over his sons and his daughters. But David drew strength from Hashem his God. The next sentence, Vayomer David erev Yosher HaKohen ben Achimelech. So David turns to the Kohen once again, pose a question to the Urim v'Tumim. Hagishon oli ha'efod, bring me the breastplate that I can pose a question. Vayagesh ev Yosher es ha'efod el David, and ev Yosher brought the breastplate to David. David inquired of Hashem, saying, shall I pursue this band? Will I overtake them? And he said to him, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the Besoruk, where some men remained behind. David pursued, he together with 400 men, while 200 men remained, who were too exhausted to cross the river Besor. They found an Egyptian man in the field and took him to David. They gave him bread and he ate, and they gave him water to drink. They gave him a cake of pressed figs and two raisin clusters, and he ate, and his spirit returned to him, for he had not eaten bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. David said to him, to whom do you belong? Where are you from? He replied, I am an Egyptian youth, the slave of an Amalekite man. My master abandoned me because I became ill 3 days ago. Once again we see the nature of these Amalekite people. We raided the south of the Kreti and the territory of Judah and the south of Kalev, and we burned down Ziklag with fire. So David asked him, will you lead me to that band? And he replied, swear to me by God that you will not kill me, nor hand me over to my master, and I will lead you to that band. So he led him there, and there they were, spread out across the face of the entire land, eating and drinking and celebrating with all the great spoils they had taken from the land of the Philistines and the land of Judah. And David smote them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them survived, except 400 youths who were riding camels who fled. So David rescued everything that Amalek had taken, and David rescued his own two wives. No one among them was missing, from small to great, sons and daughters, as well as the spoils, including everything they had taken for themselves. David returned everything. David took all the Amalekite sheep and cattle. They led them before all that livestock and said, this is the booty of David. It was great pride and honor for David. David then came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to go follow after David, whom he had stationed at the Besor Brook. And they went to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. David approached the people and inquired after their welfare. Every mean-spirited and base person of the men who had gone with David spoke up and said. It's interesting, these people are called, look at the Hebrew, Ish Ra Uvliyah, wicked and mean-spirited is is far too soft a word. Ish ra, bad people, every bad person, and Belial, every degenerate, base person, from among them said, this is from the 400 who went with David, since they did not go with me, we will not give them of the spoils that we rescued, except to each man his wife and his children, let them take them and go. We endangered ourselves, we went to war, we risked ourselves, and therefore we're entitled to the spoil. David said, "Do not act so, my brothers, with that which Hashem has given us, for he has watched over us and delivered into our hands the band that had come upon us. Who could hearken to you to such a thing? Rather, like the portion of the one who went into battle, so is the portion of the one who remained with the baggage. They shall divide it equally." And it was from that day on that David made this a decree and a law in Israel until this day. So there's an interesting dispute takes place. There's one view in the army that the spoil goes to the people who took the risks. And David says no, the spoil gets divided equally between the people who were on the front and risked their lives and the support staff who stayed behind to take care of the baggage and the things that we didn't need. The spoil is not just for the heroes. Why is that? What do we see? What is the principle? And David then enacts that as a law in his army. From then on, that had to be known. But if a person was assigned to a support task, he wasn't going to lose any of the reward. That there wasn't going to be any kind of additional glory. That it was as important to be a support staff as it was to go out into the battle. And what's the reason that David gives? The reason he gives is in verse 23. "Vayomer David, lo tasu chen echa, you will not do that, my brothers. Es asher lo san Hashem lonu, v'yishmor esonu. All that we've won, all the spoil that you're talking about, this is given to us from God. Vayishmor esonu, and he kept us. Vayiten es agdud abor leinu biyodeinu, and he gave this band of people into our hands." So the victory is not ours. If you're going to consider that the victory is an act of man, that the reason we won the war is because you were such great heroes, then you're right. You took the risks, you put yourselves out there, and you won the war. They stayed at home. But if you're going to say the war was won by God and you were merely the mechanism by which it all took place, then who knows who played more of a part? Who knows whether it was an individual who was staying behind and saying to him, while you were going out, who knows whose merit it was that saved you in the battle? Once you introduce God into the equation, then the division becomes different. Then the credit becomes different. If God is the hero, then no single man can be the hero. If God is the hero, then no single group of people can be the hero. If God is the hero, then you better say, we don't know who the heroes are, on whose behalf God did it. There could be one person, and who knows where he is, who merited the salvation for whom God did these miracles. We can't make those calculations. And therefore, if we're going to believe that this was an act of God, then we have to divide the spoils equally. Sometimes we forget miracles happen, and sometimes when the miracles are over, when the stress and the tension is over, we forget what it really was. I was fortunate enough to be in Israel just before the Six-Day War. I wasn't fortunate enough to be there during the Six-Day War, but I was there just before the Six-Day War. And to have some kind of sense of the danger, we look back at that years later, and it all looks so simple. And we blasted the Air Force in the first couple of hours, and ha ha ha, wasn't it very simple? Wasn't it very easy? We had a great army. It wasn't so simple. And when you think of the days before, and perhaps I was more fortunate being there only before, because what I remember of it was the before. I wasn't there for the euphoria of the victory. I was there for the terror. And then I left in the midst of the terror. And to give you some example of the terror, I only realized what terror it was when I started talking to soldiers. When I was in yeshiva in Kfar Chassidim. Kfar Chassidim is 40 minutes away from Haifa. The Syrian border was an hour and a half away from Kfar Chassidim. The Syrian border, if you traveled for an hour and a half or so, you would come to Kfar Chassidim, and then another 45 minutes or so, and you would come to Haifa. There was a massive army camp between Kfar Chassidim and Haifa at a crossroad, a massive army camp they put up just before the war. Overnight, this cannons and tanks, and you just saw these buildings going up. It was frightening. And I went to speak to the soldiers and to the officers there, and I said innocently, why here? And they said, because they'll get as far as that, and they pointed to the hills, Kfar Hasidim, where I was. They'll get as far as that, we can't let them get to Haifa. The assumption was they would get to that point. And when the Ponovizhirov went to Moshe Dayan and said, you know, the yeshiva boys are not in the army, but you should know they're available. At any time you need them to do anything, just let me know, and every yeshiva boy will do whatever it is that has to be done. What was Moshe Dayan, the agnostic's answer? He said, I do need them. I need them to learn and say Tehillim as hard as they can, because that's all that can save us. He said, I might need them to dig graves. That was just before the war. We forget what terror there was. These were the generals. They knew the odds. There were no odds. There wasn't a chance of winning that war. There wasn't the remotest chance of winning that war. Total miracle. When the war is won, who gets the credit? The Air Force. That's not right. When you're in terror and you're shivering and you're shaking, you say Tehillim. That's what will save the war. If you believe that, who should have got the credit after the war? The heroes should have been the yeshiva bochrim who are not in the army. According to the view of Moshe Dayan, I'm not talking about the religious parties, I'm talking about the view of the army general, of the minister of defense at the time. He said, before the war, I need them to say to him, that's the only thing that might save us. But once the war is over, we forget that kind of thing. David says, no, we don't forget. If you believe that God is involved, then we can't take credit. If we can't take credit, there are no single heroes. Then God is the hero, and in Thanksgiving we celebrate and we share out the booty among everybody equally. We don't know who it was, who's the righteous person for whom the salvation might have occurred. And so introducing the religious dimension into warfare, David comes to this conclusion and legislates this for all future battles. And in verse 26, when David arrived at Ziklag, he sent some of the spoils to the elders of Yehuda, to his friends, saying, Hinei lochem brocho, here is a brocho, mishlal oyevei Hashem. And look how he terms it. Again, I don't like the English translation. The English translation is, here is a gift for you from the spoils of the enemies of Hashem. The correct translation is, Hinei lochem brocho, here is brocho for you, here is blessing for you from the spoil of the enemies of Hashem. These were enemies of God. We went into battle on behalf of God. So who gave us the spoil? God gave us the spoil. If God gave us the spoil, it's blessing. If it's blessing, you have some too, even though you weren't in the battle. L'asher b'Beit El, he said to the people of Beit El, to the ones who were in the Ramat Negev, the ones in Yatir, the ones who were Aroer, all these different places, he sent these gifts. And in the last verse, in 31, b'l'asher b'Chevron, David sent these gifts, sent these blessings to all the places where he had been while he was traveling and being pursued. These were all people who supported him. These were all people who hid him. These were people who risked their own lives in order to protect David. And in reciprocation, now David has some wealth for the first time. The first thing he does is not only share it with the support staff of his army and all his soldiers, but he takes a large portion of it and sends it to all the people who supported him during the difficult years, when he was a nobody, when he was a nothing, when he was a bandit on the run, a rebel from the house of Saul. And these people supported him. He now, the first thing he does, he sends gifts away to them so that they understand his sense of acknowledgement and appreciation. And that leads us into chapter 31, which is the last chapter of the book. The Philistines are Flishtim Nilchomim b'Yisrael. So the battle has been going on. The Philistines, while all this is happening between David and the Amalekites and Ziklag, at the same time the Philistines are battling with Israel. Vayonusu anshe Yisrael mipnei Plishtim, and the Jewish nation fled from before the Plishtim. Vayiplu chalolim bahar Gilboa, and they fell slain on the Mount of Gilboa. Vayidbeku Plishtim es Shaul ves Bonov, and the Plishtim overtook Shaul and his sons. Vayaku Plishtim es Yehonasan, and the Plishtim killed Jonathan ves Avinodov and Avinodov ves Malkishua, Bnei Shaul, the three sons of Shaul, were all killed by the Philistines. Vatichbad Hamilchoma el Shaul, and the war became heavy on Shaul. Vayimtzu'uhu hamurim anoshim bakoshes. And the archers, men with bows who were really good, prime archers, people who had amazing aim, found Shaul. Vayochel ma'od mehamurim. And Shaul was terribly afraid of these sharpshooters. Vayomer Shaul l'noisei chelov. And so Shaul turned to his arms bearer and said, Shloif harbecho, draw your sword, v'dokreni vo, and pierce me with your sword. Pen yovoyu ha'arelim ho'ile, lest these uncircumcised heathens, the Philistines, should come, u'dekoruni, and they will pierce me. V'his'alu vi, and they will mock me and torture me. V'lo ovo noisei chelov. And the arms bearer did not obey. Kiyore merid, he was very afraid to kill the king. Vayikach Shaul es acherev, so Shaul took his own sword, vayipol oleo, and he fell upon it. Vayar moisei chelov ki mei Shaul, and when the bearer of the arms saw that Shaul had died, vayipol gamhu al charbo, he too fell on his sword, vayomosimo, and he died with his master with Shaul. Vayomos Shaul shaloshes bonov, vanoisei chelov gam kol anoshov bayomahu yachtov. And so Shaul and his three sons, and the bearer of his arms, and all his men, died together on that day. Vayiru anshe Yisrael asher be'ever ha'emek v'asher be'ever ha'yarden kinosu anshe Yisrael v'chimesu Shaul uvonov. And the people of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and the other side of the Jordan heard and saw that the Jewish people had fled and that Shaul and his sons had died. Vayazvu es ha'orim vayonusu, and they left their towns and they fled. Vayovoru plishtim vayeshvu bohen, and the plishtim came and they occupied them. Vayehi mimocharas, and it was on the next day when the Philistines came to plunder the corpses that they found Shaul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They severed his head and stripped off his gear and sent heralds all about the land of the Philistines to inform those in the temple of their idols and the people. They placed his gear in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they hung up his remains upon the wall of Beit Shan. The inhabitants of Yavesh Gilad heard about him, about what the Philistines had done to Shaul. And all the daring men arose and went throughout the night and took the remains of Shaul and the remains of his sons from the wall of Beit Shan and came back to Yavesh. They burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Yavesh, and they fasted 7 days. And so ends the tragic story of Shaul. We need to gain some insight into this dramatic suicide, and to what the view of the Torah is about it. There is an interesting Rambam in the Laws of Mourning, at the end of the first chapter of the Laws of Mourning. We don't mourn for everybody. There's an assumption now that one mourns for everybody, but that isn't really so. Strictly speaking, the Rambam gives the following law. Kol ha-porshim midarchei tzibur. Don't get excited as I read it. Wait till I'm finished. Anybody who deviates, who abandons the ways of the community. V'heim ha'anoshim sheporku ol ha'mitzvos me'al tzavoron. People who have removed the yoke of the mitzvahs from their necks. They have liberated themselves. That's the exact word, liberal Jews. Jews who have liberated themselves from the responsibility of the mitzvahs. And they are therefore not included in the Jewish community, defined by people who do mitzvahs. That's how you define the Jewish community. So the whole discussion of who is a Jew and who isn't a Jew, leaving aside who is a Jew, what is a community? A community is a people, a group of people who do the mitzvahs. The Chovet HaMoados, they honor the Yom Tov. The Yeshivas Batei Knesios, they establish shuls, and they go and they daven, they pray in the shuls. Uvasei midroshes, and houses of learning, they come to shiurim, they study. Elohareyen kivnei chorim la'atzmon, they declare themselves independently free. Now, the Rambam writes this hundreds of years before the birth of any concept of liberal Judaism. Kishar ha'umas, like the other nations, they're secular, they become secular. Kol elu en misablim alei. There is no obligation to mourn for such people when they die. The laws of mourning are suspended. Not only that, elo acheim u'shar kraveihim, what do the relatives do then? There's no mourning, no shiva. What do? Loivshim levonim, they put on white clothes instead of black clothes for mourning. They put on their Shabbos clothes. Umisatchim levonim, and they put on their best suits. Ve'oichlin v'shesiv u'smechim, and they go out to the party. They go and have a party. Sharei avdu seino shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because God's enemies have died. There's nothing to be sad about. This is a celebration. Aleihem ha'kosuvim ve'aleihem b'sanecho Hashem esno. After all, it says, those who hate you, O God, I hate too, King David himself says. That there's a hatred for those who hate God. Now, I'm reading this for a number of reasons, but particularly as it links into the next statement of the Rambam, but then I'm going to discuss it in its own right too. Ha-ma'abed atzmoy l'das. If a person commits suicide, en misaskim imoy l'chol dor, you don't get involved in his burial. Ve'en misablim alov, you don't mourn for him, then maspidi moser, and you don't give a eulogy. But you comfort the family. Because comforting the family is giving honor to the living people, and you have to honor the living people. But you don't have to show any honor to him. He's chosen to commit suicide. Now today, of course, we go into the whole question of suicide, and we tend to take it rather lightly, which is quite disturbing. Nowadays, we almost tend to say that if somebody commits suicide, he's mentally unbalanced, and therefore this law doesn't apply. But one has to be a little bit careful, because when you say that, one tends to find an increasing number of mentally unbalanced people. It's a little bit like it was with capital punishment. I see it's a little bit less so now, but there was a time, you'll remember, when anybody who murdered was considered to be mentally unstable, and so no capital punishment. And the number of murders just got more and more, which meant the number of mentally unstable people got more and more. One of the things that keep people sane is the fear of the consequences of becoming insane. It's amazing how that can work. If a person knows, behave like a meshugana and you'll get locked up there, they don't behave like meshuganas generally. Of course there are situations where people are clinically not able to help themselves, and the halacha makes very clear provision for those people. And of course there are people who commit suicide out of general psychiatric problems that are not caused by anything within their control, and they are not included in this law. But there are a whole lot of people in the grey areas, and sometimes in the not so grey areas, who are allowed to act insanely because we tolerate insanity. And yes, suicide is insane, but we dare not tolerate that insanity, because when we start tolerating that insanity, it becomes an option, and it shouldn't be an option. And part of the way that we make sure that it never becomes an option is for a person to understand what he's giving up, what it really means. I was very young and inexperienced when somebody phoned me up. I was in the middle of a meeting in business, in fact, and he called me, and a call came through to me because he insisted. He said, I'm about to commit suicide. I'm in the middle of a meeting with some non-Jewish colleagues. There's this guy, he says, I'm about to commit suicide. And I had about 2 years of rabbinic practice at that time. So I did something a little irresponsible, but it worked. I said to him, well, that's okay, I'm in the middle of a meeting now. Is it really urgent? Are you planning to do it right now, or can I call you back in an hour? He said, no, I'm doing it now. Unless you come. I said, well, I'm not coming. Forget that. So you go ahead and commit suicide. And as your rabbi, tell me what you want at the funeral. Let's discuss your funeral. Let's discuss the whole thing. Let's put it in its perspective and see. We can't have people there. We can't say Kaddish because it's suicide. But we can say, we can't give a hesped. But what would you like me to say about you? Do you want to say anything? Who would you like to be there? Who should we notify? What time? Let's see. If you're going to commit suicide within the next half hour, we can still have the funeral today. Is that what you would want? Is that what we should do? And the thing became so real for him. And then I put the phone down. And I was very, very worried the whole day. But he's still alive today, living well. I don't know if it was an irresponsible thing to do or not. It happened to work. But part of what keeps us from doing insane things is picturing the consequence of that insanity. And if there is no consequence to that insanity, insanity is sometimes quite a comfortable option. People go crazy, and I don't mean it in a clinical sense. They sometimes lose their tempers, they get into a rage, they do all sorts of unacceptable things because we tolerate it. And the moment we cease to tolerate it, it's strange how quickly people start becoming normal again. And suicide is one of those areas. But the same applies to, and I need to be a little bit careful, because I don't like labeling people or organizations or groups of people. But to those people, and the Rambam is not talking about a person who has never had the opportunity to study and to appreciate Judaism. The Rambam is not talking about those people who've never been able to be exposed to what Judaism really is and to the depths of Judaism. The Rambam is talking about people who have been exposed to it, who know what it is, who understand exactly what it is, and who choose to liberate themselves from it. Now the question is, do we censure that or don't we? If we become too tolerant, as we're becoming in this country, where we're tolerant of anything, absolutely anything we're tolerant of, we don't like presidents who lie, but they can do anything else, or we don't like presidents who caught lying, and we don't like murder, and we don't like rape, and we're not too happy about theft. But apart from that, we'll tolerate anything. And the more we tolerate anything, the more we will be given that which we tolerate. And the same applies Jewishly. We tolerate anything. Is there a time where a Jewish community says, no, this we don't tolerate? Not a question of not tolerating it morally. That's a human issue. That's got nothing to do with the Jewish community. There are certain attitudes and practices that we don't tolerate as a community. Now, how does that weigh in with freedom of each individual to make his own choices? Well, the answer is really very simple if one thinks it's true. If you want to make your own choices about what you practice and what you don't, that's your choice. As I make my own choices about what I practice and what I don't. And we all practice some of the Torah. None of us practice all of the Torah. That's the freedom. But when you philosophically justify the abandonment of principles of the Torah, then you're undermining the Torah. Then you're undermining the community. Person says, I don't want to keep Shabbos. Then I failed as a rabbi, I failed as a teacher. That's all. But if a person establishes a community of people who believe it is not necessary to keep Shabbos, then he is attacking the very fundamentals of Jewish community life. If a person wants to believe in, propagate, and develop philosophies that are different to the Torah and market them as Judaism, if he wants to market it as some other religion, that's fine, it's been done before. That's not a problem. But don't market it as Judaism, because that's fraud. If a person wants to paint a picture and he says to me, this is not a Rembrandt, this is a me, that's fine. If he wants to say, and you know what, I'm greater than Rembrandt, good for you, be greater than Rembrandt. But I am free to decide whether I agree with you or not. But don't paint something that looks almost like a Rembrandt and fake Rembrandt's signature on it and come and tell me that it's a Rembrandt. So if you want to make a different brand of religion and call it a different religion, go ahead. No problem. Remain my friend. But don't come and tell me it's Judaism. And don't pick on innocent people who don't know what is Judaism and what isn't Judaism and market that as Judaism too. And I said a couple of weeks ago, and I'll say it again, that there aren't a whole lot of different, in this country one can get confused by so many things, but even by Judaism one can get confused in this country. Orthodox, extreme, ultra-Orthodox, liberal, conservative, reform, all these different names of Jewish groupings. There are two Jewish groupings, Orthodox and liberal. There are no more. It's as simple as that. Orthodox are those people who accept the Torah, irrespective of how much of it they choose to practice, but they accept the Torah. They are Orthodox people. They are Orthodox people that keep a lot, they are Orthodox people that don't keep a lot. And then there's another body of people, people who do not accept the Torah, people who modify the Torah, people who change the Torah, people who manipulate the Torah, people who pick and choose what suits them from the Torah. That's liberal. And those are the two groupings. Any attempt to make them more than those two groupings simply obscures. And one has to be very careful in understanding that. And sometimes there are groups that market themselves as Orthodox, and they are not Orthodox. Sometimes there are individuals who maybe belong to a conservative grouping, but as a person, as an individual, they're not conservative, they're not liberal, they're Orthodox people. The test is, do I accept the Torah or don't I accept the Torah? But when you have people who establish and practice a liberation from the Torah, and sell that as Judaism. Says the Rambam, when they die, what are you mourning? What are you sad about? Can a religious, mourning is a religious process, that you're personally sad, fine. You want to personally mourn, you, of course you're entitled to personally mourn. The Rambam is not suggesting that as an individual related to this person, you don't feel some sadness. The Rambam is saying, do we institute the Jewish process of mourning for a person who has undermined Judaism? Do you institute the Jewish process of mourning, the Torah's system of mourning, to honor a person who has spent his life undermining everything that is the Torah? The answer is no, there are principles. You don't do that. You don't use the beauty and the elegance and the sophistication and the refinement of the Torah's mourning process for a person who lived undermining the whole Torah. Imagine what would happen today if that were the case. If a rabbi got up and said, this person we don't have to mourn for, this person we do, intolerant and all sorts of things. These are principles. And if one analyzes the principles unemotionally, the principles are right. The principles are true. You don't decorate a traitor. You don't do that. You decorate a hero. And mourning is a decoration process. Mourning is decorating a person. Mourning is giving a person a medal after his lifetime. That's what it is. Coming to a funeral, honoring him, spending 7 days, his children spending a year, saying Kaddish. This is decoration. And it's the Torah's decoration. It's not personal decoration. You don't have to be Jewish to mourn personally. We're talking about religious decoration. You don't decorate a person who is a traitor. And there are some people who are ignorant. There are some people who don't appreciate. Those aren't traitors. And that's most of the people today. Looks around at a country such as the United States. Most Jews in the United States aren't traitors. They're not Orthodox. They're not. They don't know. They just don't know. They never had the opportunity to learn. But the leaders of movements designed to market distortions as Judaism, those people we shouldn't be decorating. No mourning. Included in that is the suicide. Comes the question, what about Shaul? How did he do that? Something that is so severe that he's put in the same category as people who've undermined the essence of Torah, that are treated, a person who's committed suicide is treated, as far as mourning is concerned, the same way as a person who's been a traitor to Judaism. How does Saul allow himself the luxury of committing suicide as an option? There are various different approaches to the answer. But there is a work called the Yamshel Shlomo. The Yamshel Shlomo is a work by the Marshal, who was a rov in Krakow at the time of the Ramor. So this was the time of the Shulchan Aruch, about the 15th century, an important halakhic authority. And he works it a different way. Let me give you some background to the way he sees it. Let me learn a piece of Gemara with you first. We might have used part of this Gemara in a previous shiur in connection with a different issue. Gemara is in Yuma Dev Peivav. The Gemara says, how can it say in the first paragraph of the Shema, Ve'ahavto es Hashem Elokecha, that you shall love the Lord your God? How can you love God? It's not lovable. How do you love something that you can't see, that you can't touch, that you don't know, that is beyond you in every sense? Explains the Gemara, it doesn't mean that you must love God. What it means is, Sheyehei Shem Shemayim Mis'ahev Al Yodecho. You should facilitate the love of God. Your actions should bring about the love of God. For example, Sheyehei Korei V'Shoinei M'Shamish Tamidei Chachomim. You can have a person who has learnt a great deal, knows the whole of Tanakh, knows all of the Mishnah, has studied the whole of Shas, all of Gemara, and he deals in a pleasant and fine way with people. His business dealings and his communication with people is good and is fine. What do people say about him? Ashrei Oviv Shelimdo Torah. Lucky is his father who taught him Torah. Ashrei Rabbi Shelimdo Torah. Isn't his teacher fortunate to have been the teacher of such a fine man? What a tragedy for those who have not been exposed to the Torah. Look how beautiful this person conducts himself because he's learned Torah. However, if somebody has learnt a great deal and knows the whole of Tanakh and the whole of Mishnah and all of Gemara, ve'ein masol matzomer be'emuno, but he doesn't deal nicely in business, he's not trustworthy, ve'ein diburo benachasim abrius, and when he speaks to people, he doesn't speak with fineness, he speaks with coarseness, ma'abrius oimer selov, what do people say about him? What a terrible thing, such a man learned Torah. What a waste. Look what Torah does to people. His poor father who taught him Torah, his poor teacher who taught him Torah. Look at a person who's learned Torah, how bad he is. But all of our about such a person, the Torah says in Yechezkel, and this is the important part for this discussion. About such people, it says, when they will comment, Am Hashem Eile Umeato Yotzo. These are the Jewish people and they come from the Holy Land. Look at them. That's the terrible thing that comes out as a result of that. Explains Rashi. Et Zu Koro HaKosov Chilul Hashem. That's defined by the Torah as a Chilul Hashem. Now very often you'll hear people saying that Chilul Hashem, which means to desecrate God's name, which is one of the worst things we can do, if not the worst, and one of the things for which we have to rather give our lives. But if we're in danger of desecrating God's life, God's name, we should rather give our lives. Sometimes you'll hear it said that applies, Chilul Hashem applies among Jews, but not among non-Jews. Explains Rashi. This is called Chilul Hashem. Kesher Odom Choshuv Oyver Avero. When an important man does something wrong, Ufuronus Bo'olov, and as a result of that, God punishes him, and he suffers. And what do people say? What does it help him? He's been such a righteous man, he's been such a good man, and now he's suffering. See these righteous and wise people, they also suffer. As it says, they have profaned my name. Uvamechilu, says Rashi. What is the profanation? When the non-Jews say about the Jews, among whom the Jews find themselves, look at the Jewish people, they're suffering and God can't save them. The name of God is profaned and his honor is diminished. What is Rashi teaching us here? There are two elements in this piece of Gemara that we learn. The one is the simple concept of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. But it is necessary to facilitate greater closeness with God through one's interaction with people. That whenever one interacts with people, the outcome should be that the other person says, if that's a religious Jew or if that's a Jew, isn't that great? Isn't that wonderful? There must be something in it. There must be something in godliness. There must be something in religion. I want more of that. When it has the opposite effect of somebody looking at a religious person or a Jewish person and saying, if that's what it is, I want nothing of it, that's called Chilul Hashem. That's called profaning God's name. That's the one element of it. Furthermore, who are the arbitrators of whether a person is pleasant or not? There again, you'll often hear people saying, the goyim in the street, the non-Jews in the street, aren't going to determine what actions of mine are acceptable and what aren't. Yes, people say that sometimes. That's it. I don't have to play to a non-Jewish audience. I do what I believe is right, and who cares what they think of me? What we see here is that isn't so. The Gemara quite clearly states, Mahabriyas Omer Salav. What does humanity say about such a person? The test of sanity, the test of correctness, the test of pleasantness, is not what people in your community say. The test of pleasantness is what does the ordinary man in the street say. And if the ordinary man in the street says ugly, the chances are you're ugly. If the ordinary man in the street says insane, the chances are that we're insane. We've got to listen to the ordinary man of the street as well. Not about our moral conduct. It's not for the man in the street to decide whether I can learn Gemara or not. It's not for the man in the street to decide whether something you're doing is moral or not. That's decided by your own conscience and your knowledge of the Torah. But if it's a question of my soul, my tonoi, in my brius be'emuno, about trustworthy business relations, if the question is about diburo benachas, communicating in a pleasant way, that's not just to ask the people in your community, that's to ask anybody that sees you operating. anybody that interacts with you. And if there's anybody out there, it can be a person from China, it can be a person from Africa, it can be a person from anywhere in the world, an Eskimo from Alaska, looks at you and says, that's ugly. I don't like the way that person dealt with me. I don't like the way that person communicates with me. It's not fine. That's Chilul Hashem. And we can't say, what does he know about fineness? He's just an Eskimo. Mahabriyas Emris. We want to know, what are the Briyas? What does humanity say about me? That's critically important. And the proof is from the verse in Yechezkel. When the non-Jews say, is that the Jewish people? Then we know we've caused the Chilul Hashem. And Rashi now takes it further and says, part of that Chilul Hashem is, when we do something wrong, and God punishes us, which he has to do, and non-Jews see that and say, all Jews, and say, look, a righteous person, a religious person, and he's suffering. So God obviously doesn't have much power. Otherwise, why is he making him suffer? So when we do things wrong, and thereby cause or bring punishment upon ourselves, not only are we doing wrong, but we're also doing Chilul Hashem. We're also profaning God's name. Now let's go to Shaul. Shaul finds himself in a situation where he knows with absolute certainty that he is going to be struck down. He knows. Not only because he can see the way the battle is going, and that he's lost his army and he's surrounded by the sharpshooters, that he can see as well. But he's been told already with prophecy. He's been told by Samuel's spirit. It's no question. And he's seen his sons have already died, so he sees the prophecy coming true. So he knows that the Philistines are going to kill him. They're going to gloat over that killing him. They're going to celebrate the killing of him. And that's going to be a victory not against Saul, that they've got already. A victory against Saul they've got. A victory against the Jewish people they've got. But when they finally put that sword into Saul, that's going to be a victory against God. And that Saul has to be willing to take one's own life to avoid a Chilul Hashem. And says Shaul, I've done wrong, and because I've done wrong, I'm being punished. I don't want anybody else to take the credit for my punishment. I don't want anybody to believe or to think. They don't know that I've done wrong. They think I'm the Messiah. They think I'm God's chosen one. They don't know what's transpired between God and me, between Samuel and me, between Samuel and David, between God and David. They look at me as the figurehead. They think I'm still God's man. So when they kill me, what will they think? We've killed God. We've overcome God. We're more powerful than God. That I won't have. And so the last thing I can do for God is to take my own life. And that's what Shaul does. And in that, he earns his world to come. Samuel prophesied, if you go into battle with honor and you die with dignity, and Shaul knew exactly what that meant, what that obligation was, and tomorrow you will be here with me with a clean slate, a pure unblemished soul, not in any way tainted by the mistakes you made, by the wrong actions that you committed during your lifetime. All of that will be erased by your act of Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying God's name in the last moments of your life. And so even at that moment Shaul decides to do that. We see, apart from anything else, we see the sanctity of life, we see the power of life, that even in the last moments of a person's life, he has the capacity to cleanse his soul. He has the capacity to become a hero. That even as a man is about to die, he has the capacity to take those last moments of his life and to use them to retrospectively cleanse his entire life and to uplift his soul and to thereby acquire a place of honor and dignity in the world to come. And that's one of the reasons that we're so concerned about any movement towards euthanasia. That what we might be depriving a person of, we don't know. Yes, there's pain and there's suffering. Of course, that's something of great concern. I'm not suggesting that it's our obligation to extend people's life in suffering. It's not our obligation to do that at all. But to take people's lives, when we don't know what they might have done in a moment of glory just before they die, to deprive them of that opportunity, no human being is entitled to take that decision and to deprive anybody, even at that person's request, of that moment of glory. And the servant of Shaul doesn't commit euthanasia. Shaul asks him to kill him, and he refuses. You'll have to do that yourself. And Shaul does it himself. And only afterwards does the young man commit suicide himself. That's the story of Shaul. The country is left in quite a mess when David takes over. The Philistines have conquered it. Shaul has been lost. His sons have been lost. There's been a devastating battle. And David walks into the throne in this kind of environment, which we'll pick up after Purim. But in the last few minutes of this year, I would like to ask some of you, those of you who've thought about it, I wouldn't like people who are only thinking about it for the first time now to comment, because that would be unfair. But people who've thought about it over the period of time, if I were to ask you, what do you learn from Shaul, the life of this man? What does it mean to you? We've watched this man grow from obscurity into great heights. We've watched him fall. We've watched him struggle. We've watched him lose. We've watched him regain. What does he mean to you? What do you learn from him? What do you see? What does this man conjure up in your mind in terms of a picture of humanity? Is there anybody who would like to share any ideas on what the life of Shaul has meant to you as you've studied it through the weeks, through the months, in fact, for more than a year in this sefer?
Even God decided that he is the most qualified person to be the first king of Israel. Face power, regain position, and that was totally restored from the power and the ruling that he had in his hand to a point that he destroyed himself.
So you see tragic self-destruction. And then you see a rise to power and then a fall all the way, downhill all the way from there.
Control, what he had in his hand in a positive
okay.
direction, he twisted to the wrong direction,
totally
out of line.
Okay, so other viewpoints? Yes. The depression that came out of the conflict, of the inner conflict that he was battling. Interesting. The insanity of living a life that isn't integrous, of a life where the role you're playing is not the person you are, and the impacts of that. Nice, interesting.
Even if you're picked up by God, you're no guarantee.
Nice. Even if you're chosen by God.
Chosen by God to be the first king of Israel.
You end your own after that.
And that's the proof. He couldn't live up to what Hashem expected him to be, the quality of kingship that Hashem expected. Okay?
Nice, which means that when we'll learn of David's successes, we've got to realize that that wasn't a gift of God either.
Exactly.
That what he achieves was his own achievements, just as Shaul's failings were his own failings, so the successes, Shaul's included, that we learnt about are man's own successes. But success and failure doesn't come from God, we're our own. Yeah, he didn't, perhaps more accurately, he didn't always hear God. Not that he didn't listen to God, it's as if he heard God and didn't listen. He didn't always hear clearly. And that's, of course, the big issue. If we could hear clearly and do that, would be no problem. The difficulty is in, do we hear clearly? And how does one hear clearly? Even a man as great as that, at times, didn't hear the message clearly and didn't implement what he was expected to do, and that started the trouble. That's correct. Any others? Is it? Lovely, beautiful. If you look at what was the downfall of Shaul, we're all saying this and that, and he did it, he made bad choices. What could he have done differently? He could not have had Doeg as an advisor. If he wouldn't have had Doeg so close, he wouldn't have destroyed himself. He would have made a few mistakes, but he would have picked himself up again. Sometimes our destruction and our damage is caused by people who claim to be close to us, and they're destructive forces, undermining forces. And had he surrounded himself with people of higher caliber, he might have been able to pull himself through. But that was his. That was the impact. That last one. Also valid. He wasn't. It wasn't a deliberate disobedience of God. Isn't it? Wasn't one of these people who liberated himself from God's influence. On the contrary, he was trying to satisfy. And that is impossible. At the end of the day, there's a need to do what's right and try and sell it as best we can. But not everybody's going to be satisfied, and that's just how it is. Okay, I think we're going to leave it there and pick up, as I mentioned, next week we'll probably hear more of the details, but next week we'll have a Purim party, and the week thereafter we'll pick up with the beginning of the second book of Samuel, the life of King David. Thank you.